and the Program Director of Environmental Planning in the Department of Environmental Geography at Macquarie University in Sydney. And he had completed his PhD on the London Greenbelt at the University of Tsukuba. Am I pronouncing that right? Yes, okay. In Japan. And he's author of several publications on the subject of greenbelts, including an edited book, Urban Greenbelts in the 21st Century. He and I also edited a special edition of the journal Planning, Practice, and Research, which is about greenbelts in an international context, trying to have an understanding of the kinds of issues that greenbelts in different places are facing and the people who are dealing with them. Marco grew up in London. He was trained as an environmental scientist, but then he decided that he was really interested in planning. And he became very excited by the work of a gentleman by the name of Makoto Yokohari in Japan, and then decided to go there to learn Japanese, do a PhD, and that's just amazing. And so he's been studying environmental control ever since. We have been at International Greenbelt Conference this week, as we have with Roger. Thank you very much for coming again today. And Sarah McDonald from the City Institute was also there, and we had a great discussion and very lively presentations about the kinds of issues that people are dealing with around the world. It was a lot of them were in a European context, and so I'm very interested to hear what Mark has to say today about green belts in that context. So thank you very much.
Oh, thanks. I hope that maybe I should just do this sitting down, because this is a fairly small room. But thank you very much for coming, especially when I can imagine when any of you went to the Greenbelt Conference yesterday, you might all be completely greenbelted out by now. Thank you, Laura, for your kind introduction. I mean, to be honest, it's not that amazing to go to Japan to do a PhD. When I was there, there was a Cuban student that I got to know who, in the space of 6 months, not only started a PhD, but got married, had a child, and started an Indian restaurant. So, people do sort of strange and interesting things, I think, in their first year of a PhD. And one of my kind of, my first year of a PhD was sort of dominated by a search for different topics. Eventually, I kind of landed on this topic of greenbelts, because it was the thing that really stuck out in the planning system between Japan and between the UK. The Green Belt in Japan had failed in the 1950s, as I'll explain, but the Green Belt in London and in the UK more broadly was held up as this paragon of planning success. And so the question for my supervisors and for the sort of Japanese audience that I was catering to was how on earth the Green Belt worked. And I, of course, understood it as somebody from the UK as something much more problematic. And so I guess that motivated me to look into the Greenbelt, but also to use it as a lens for thinking about lots of different things in planning, from property rights to success and failure of planning. So this is a kind of a selection, I guess, of some of the work that I've done in this area over the last 6 or 7 years or so, as well as an explanation for the question that people tend to ask me the most, which is, why on earth you ended up doing a study on the London Greenbelt when you were all the way in Japan from the UK. So, yeah, I mean, understanding your audience is important. But I'll start with this photograph behind me. This is a wonderful example of planning graffiti put there by the nearby residents. This was in a field on the edge of northern edge of London. And it's interesting because this field was, you can actually see it in the photograph, there's a little post there with a white marker on the bottom left of the photograph. And that little post is a demarcation boundary. And this was a time of some hesitation in the policy area in planning in around sort of 2004, 2005. The government were putting out some messages that they were going to dismantle the Green Belt and all this land on the edges of London was going to be released. And so because subdivision in the UK is not controlled at all. You can get a lawyer, you can subdivide land any way you want. What some speculators have done was they bought agricultural land, they just divided it up, had said this is going to be, you know, developable land in 5 years' time, and people on the internet in places like India, they were moving to the UK, had actually bought, you know, effectively worthless pieces of agricultural land. So it was a kind of a big scandal, and I think the residents in this area were very worried that this huge number of landowners interacting with this area was something that put a large amount of pressure on the planning system to sort of release that land.
What was under the orange? Nuclear missiles?
Under there, who knows? I think it was another Greenbelt protest, so they'd gone back and tried to put something again. But anyway, yeah, I've titled this Guides to Setting Up and Running Multifunctional Peri-Urban Spaces because the last sort of 2 days or so have been very interesting to me to come here to Toronto to find there's so much enthusiasm for the Greenbelt, whereas I mean, from the UK, it's, as you'll see, it's something that's not necessarily supported across the board. So it's been a very surreal experience to come here and to see people, you know, punching the air, as it were, and saying, green belt, here we go. And it's kind of certainly reawakened a lot of interest in the subject for me. So just to start, I mean, I'll talk about three different scales of green belt planning. The first is the local scale, then I'll talk about the regional scale, and then I'll talk about the national scale. And when I talk about the national scale, I think what I think is most interesting is how the Greenbelt relates to discourses about planning in general, how the Greenbelt supports the idea of planning and how it effectively goes against it. But to begin with, just the local advocacy groups, property interests, and local authorities. And what I mean by these things is specifically in the case of London, advocacy groups in the when the London Greenbelt was set up, were sort of a whole range of incredibly well-supported, largely sort of aristocratic organisations. I should mention, I'll talk about sort of quite a detailed history of the in-depth history of the London Greenbelt, but also at the end of each section, the local, the regional, the national, I want to talk about the wider implications of this, hopefully, for introducing Toronto to other international environments. So for advocacy groups, you've got the Council for the Preservation of Rural England, which I'll talk about in a minute. You've got a large amount of aristocratic land holdings. You've got on the outskirts of cities. So that was sort of the property structure, as it were, which was very important. So big land holdings and agricultural depression during the end of the 19th century. And so depressed agricultural land prices. And you've also got an amazing range of cooperation, informal networks, spying, what was very, very enigmatically called secret bargains being made at the local level to try and ensure that the green belt was actually set up in the London case. So just to start off with, this is a little introduction to one of the sort of the big players in all of this. It's this Council for the Preservation of Rural England, set up in 1926. And they were incredibly skillful at arranging images of the public, which could have contrasted bucolic scenes such as this, here, or this, with kind of early images of sprawls such as this, and this, you know, sort of the horror effectively of post First World War sprawl development on the outskirts of cities. If you imagine there wasn't any real control over the type of development that occurred. I think these kind of polemic attacks on the urban development that was occurring at the time are very, very similar to the sorts of things that you hear Andras Duaney talking about or new urbanists talking about today. If you ever look at the TED Talk empowered Künstlers talk, you've got very, very similar types of figures at that time taking place in the UK. But also, what was interesting about the CPRE was the involvement of Patrick Abercrombie. I'm sorry, it's so pixelated, but I'll read out the quote for you in a minute. Patrick Abercrombie was one of the founders of the CPRE, the Council for the Preservation of Rural England, went on to become one of the most well-known planners of the 20th century. So he variously planned London after the Second World War, but also went on extensive consultancy visits and so on. Even his last job, sort of shortly before he died in 1926, was to plan Addis Ababa. So, I mean, such was his range and his importance. I mean, what it says here, what I want you to point out, is that the parts we could preserve at all costs, they hoped to get wealthy landowners to agree not to sell to the builder, but to preserve their land either as open space or as agricultural space. So there you can see Abercrombie foregrounding this whole notion that landowners should actually give up their land for free in the Greenbelt, and that was kind of largely expected of landowners at the time. Now, as well as the Council for the Preservation of Rural England, you had a number of other concerns about playing fields in particular. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was, of course, the Boer War in South Africa, and the recruits that were taken from urban areas were found to be in incredibly poor condition compared to rural recruits. And because effectively the British almost lost that particular war against the Boers, they were incredibly concerned about the health of the urban population. So the poor urban people were much shorter, they were less fit, effectively, they couldn't run as quickly into barbed wire as the people wanted them to. So there was this whole movement to try and get people more active. You can see this very interesting photograph here. You've got the big sturdy man and sort of the kind of Oliver Twist type of figure with hunched shoulders there, being asked to join the go away from the industrial pollution on the right-hand side. Now, this National Playing Fields Organization mandated a ratio which became incredibly important. Actually, one of these sort of ratios that crop up from time to time in planning, it was something like 7 acres of playing fields per 1,000 population. It's the sort of normative standard that was used, and that was copied in other countries, such as Australia, for example. And it was supported, among others, by a long, long list of aristocratic grandees, including at the head the Duke and Duchess of York, who were, of course, later to become the King and Queen of England. So you had these kind of effectively elitist organisations, such as the Council for the Preservation of Rural England, the National Playing Fields Association, that were advocating very, very strongly both for containing urban growth, but also for increasing the amount of public open space for the broader public. You had, as I said before, aristocratic landholdings, and you also had a large range of cooperation among different actors in different ways. I want to just highlight these quotes here from minutes of different archives in and around London. I did an extensive search as part of my PhD on the sort of, I guess you call it, the daily grind of trying to implement a greenbelt in the 1920s and 30s. These are just sort of some of the highlights of some of those, but you'll have to sort of take it for granted that there's a lot more material behind all of this. It's not just a few quotes. For example, here, the moment is the practice of many estate agents to forward particulars of any properties of which they have to dispose. So any time that they're actually going to sell a piece of land, the estate agents will actually contact the council and say, hey, you know, this one's coming up for land, would you like to buy it, for example, for the green belt?
Would not divulge that main motive in asking for a general sanction was that they might be able to purchase by the method of a secret bargain.
So once the local authorities had become aware of the potential sale of a field on the outskirts of London or something, they would rush in and try to communicate with the landowner secretly to try and negotiate with that landowner and convince them to sell the land cheaply. To kind of give a bit of background to all of this, I mean, this was taking place in the between 1935 and 1937. During those 2 years, the London County Council gave a very generous grant of £2 million to local authorities to apply to buy the Greenbelt. So, you know, you've got something similar going on here in Toronto with the Oak Ridges Foundation, for example. Is that right? I mean, you've got a foundation there of people who are trying to buy up land and have it preserved in the Greenbelt. What I'm kind of focused on was this little piece of land called Ockham Common. And what was incredible to me was that, I can't remember exactly what the purchase price was, but not only was it funded by the London County Council, and the purchase was also funded by the local authorities, but neighbouring landowners also pitched in to the tune of around 16% of the whole purchase price for buying this piece of land, because it was somehow well recognised that they would get some kind of a property benefit from having preserved land next to them. So, I mean, I don't think it was necessarily altruistic, but there was a whole range of different ways in which local authorities effectively worked the system and the tools that they had and the networks that they had to try and influence Greenbelt at that time. They also used very kind of, you might say, archaic schemes. There must have been a great deal of head scratching to try and work out, well, how can we possibly, you know, get this land preserved in some ways. There was talk of sterilizing the land, which was effectively paying a landowner not to develop the land, something similar you have in the United States with transfer of development rights schemes, something along those lines, or this landmass rights. I guess you call it agricultural easements, which is sort of effectively tying the landowner into a contract where they just promise to be a farmer for the rest of the time. So they're proposing to sort of, the council was proposing to set up an agreement that they impose those landmass rights on landowners.
Where does that word come from? What kind of word is it?
Landmass is it's a Norman term. It's really, I mean, you know, as I said, totally arcane. This idea about particular rights associated with particular activities in the UK. That's where I've looked it up. I've never heard it before as well. So, yeah, and I haven't actually seen it since.
But I guess it just shows you the lengths to which people were prepared to go to try and look for any kind of which way they could to preserve the land.
There was this quote here: the purchase price might be again be reduced by allowing Lord Dysart and his successor to remain in possession during their lives. Lord Dysart is 75 years of age and his successor is 81. According to the tables, the expectation of life is 6 years.
Very dryly remarked by the planner at the time. So, you know, they were willing to enter into some sort of an agreement to keep the landowner on the land, but then, of course, that land will revert to the council later on. As a result of these efforts, there was prior to this 1935 to 1937, I guess you call it a grant scheme now, there was this Greater London Regional Planning Committee with a very famous planner called Raymond Unwin, who set out the Green Girdle of London. And as a result of this scheme, they bought around 4,000 hectares of land, which amounted to effectively around 20% of the whole planning idea. So each of the local authorities kind of collaborating and working with these different networks. Now, the other point I wanted to mention was about this higher level support, because of course it wasn't just the planners working, it wasn't just the Ministry of Health which had the power to control planning at that time, but it was also all the various other departments around the fringes, as it were, that were also very supportive of this whole idea of preservation. And this case here highlights the commissioner of the Crown Lands. Now, this man's job was to possess land for the state and, where necessary, to sell it off at the highest price possible. So that's what that quote says there. It's bound to pay the full value, and does in practice pay the full value of the land to the highest bidder. Now, this man, his name was Mr. Stocks. Mr. Stocks was given a direct appeal by the Council for the Preservation of Rural England. He was advised that this is a very dangerous matter to express views on. Nonetheless, as you can see here in his handwriting, he's written, "I'm delighted at the thought of saving some of this land from jerry builders." It concerned basically the sell-off of a large airfield on the outskirts of London that was being... could have remained as an airfield, or could have gone for housing, which was also a very necessary activity at that time. He says, "You'll note of January 19th about Hainault, that's the name of the airfield. I will gladly help you inform the RE deserve it." So here was this person who was morally and legally obliged to sell land, sort of trying to delay sell-off of this airfield, effectively talking to these NGOs, because he was passionate about the countryside and the preservation of England. I mean, it's a... just a small case to sort of highlight that it wasn't just about the planners themselves, but it was also the kind of, you might almost call it the aristocratic milieu, or the elite around this whole concept of green belts. Green belts, or green girdles, as they were called at that time, were an incredibly powerful concept. And I think that from time to time, these powerful concepts emerge in planning and almost become a parallel planning system to the existing mandates and legislative ways of behaving. One of the interesting presentations during the last 2 days was about the Copenhagen Finger Plan, which is a world-famous regional plan. I'm sure you've heard of it. We've got sort of corridor planning in Copenhagen. And this was planned after the Second World War, but it didn't actually become part of the legislation until 2007. But nonetheless, everybody followed this Copenhagen Finger Plan because it was such a powerful concept. And the same, to a certain extent, I think, goes for Greenbelt planning. You know, Greenbelt planning is, as one of the people at the conference said, so simple that even politicians can understand it. So, and I think that's probably the same for what was happening here. You've got this very, very simple concept. Let's just really get rid of this sprawl. Let's try and contain, you know, the Great Wen, London, and stop it from raping the countryside. And let's try and contain it. So there was a lot of support for people.
Why was the word "girdle" changed? Did it sound Germanic?
I don't know, actually. It could have been that. I think this man, David Matless, has written a very interesting book called Landscape and Englishness, which he goes into the whole sort of cultural geography of preservation attempts at that time. And there are remarkably kind of, you might almost say, gendered approaches to development and to urban sprawl at that time. So the urban sprawl was seen as this kind of masculine force that was raping, you know, Mother Nature, as it were, quite literally. So I think the sort of the word girdle kind of invokes this idea of a kind of chastity belt of some kind. But anyway, I was dropped because I think perhaps the word belt is perhaps a neutral, less marketable. When we look at the case of Toronto with the, you know, advocacy groups, property interests, and the way in which local authorities behave, I guess I don't have any kind of particular information about Toronto, but I think it's crucial to understand, to look at something like the Greenbelt Foundation, the Friends of the Greenbelt. Greenbelt Foundation and how they operate, and to try and understand that through, for example, case studies or interviews of what actually takes place on the ground, to try and look for these instances of secret bargaining or negotiations taking place. I think it's very crucial to understand the individual property rights and the way in which property interests work at the local level. I think that there's a sort of caricature of all of this, isn't there, that you've got greenbelt preservation or preservation of land is necessarily going to come into conflict with the way developers think. My research later on in the greenbelt, when I did interviews with developers and so on, revealed that they're completely supportive of the greenbelt because of their investment horizon. So today, in London, much of the greenbelt is not owned anymore by aristocratic estates, but it's owned by huge property companies, life insurance schemes, and people like that. Now, those sorts of people aren't, as Margaret Atwood put it yesterday, hit-and-run developers. I mean, these are people with very, very long-term investment horizons. And because of that, they support the greenbelt, because if the greenbelt was suddenly released, it would dramatically drop the price of land. So they actually look upon the greenbelt as a stabilizing mechanism in the land market, because that's basically what the investment horizons are. So, you know, you've got sort of very interesting parallels from the system in 1920 to the way things actually operate today. Okay, now thinking about the regional, and I just want to highlight a couple of things in this case that makes a greenbelt work in practice. Looking at the time. dynamic meanings and, of course, regional networks. And in terms of the dynamic meanings, I think there's some really interesting stuff going on, again, in the 1920s and 30s. And I've put, green parkways, aerodromes, and golf courses. Now, this is a quote, again, from Mr. Stocks. And he said, is simply to invent every kind of possible public user which will preserve the property as an open space. So he didn't really mind, when he was selling off this airfield, what the actual use was. He was just kind of totally flexible about this idea of use. As long as the central idea, which of course was never actually debated or argued, was that it remained open space. So what you have, in effect, is this central motivation is to preserve open space at all costs. And that is never debated with anybody or even freely expressed. But what you have is a series of layers of meaning that go on top of that hidden discourse of preservation at all costs. And you can see that taking place in different forms in a very graphical way with these maps, for example. This is a very early 1920s parkway map for London. This is the one corner of the map here. You can see the blue lines vaguely being sort of dotted in, a big parkway, a sort of American idea of having a kind of just a big road where you can exercise your car in a sort of sylvan surrounding. And, a few dots here and there where they might think about preserving some green space along the way. I don't actually think whether that had any big influence. But I think actually it does vaguely follow there's an orbital motorway around London called the M25, so I never actually looked into whether it does do that. There was a regional organization at the time called the Greater London Regional Planning Committee, headed up by another aristocratic toff, I guess you call it, called Ronald Hardy Sims. And here he is talking about how it's very important to talk about the national character of value and making an appeal to the air ministry. And this man systematically went to different ministries in London, the air ministry, the army ministry. I think he even tried the treasury, but of course was rebuffed, to try and appeal for funds to have the Greenbelt implemented prior to this scheme of 1935 to 1937. So they tried very, very hard to get some kind of funding up. And this appeal to the air ministry is particularly interesting
as you can see in this map here. At the time,
if you imagine, in the 1920s and 30s, they just had this massive growth of car ownership. And so they logically assumed that from car ownership, people would go on to buying planes and flying lots and lots of planes. And there's a very famous image from the 1930s at the time of Sydney planning. Centre of Sydney was to be dominated by this massive skyscraper with landing pads. You could actually fly a biplane into the skyscraper and park it there. So there was this great confidence that somehow aeroplanes would come to sort of dominate our lives, although they have to a certain extent. I mean, it's not, I think aeroplane travel remains perhaps one of the last bastions of public transport as opposed to individual transport. And it was just imagined that aeroplanes would go the same way, that they would become individual transport for the masses. And so as part of that, of course, you had to plan for all these aerodromes around London and airports. And so each of these circles here, these blocks, were projected landing areas. You know, you needed to reserve a certain amount of land free of buildings to land your aeroplane. So each of these circles here around London, you've got a huge, huge number, were to be reserved for allowing people to land their plane. But of course, as you can tell in the context of this, the reason why this is interesting, it's no coincidence that all of these circles towards the centre happen to connect up. And so thus, the argument for Greenbelt is eloquently and elegantly made. Okay. There was also the whole idea of golf for the masses, as well, something sort of slightly unrealistic compared to sort of the aristocratic and elite origins of golf playing in the UK. And there's this plan here for including a whole range of playing fields around London. So the meaning of the Greenbelt was very, very flexibly changed according to the different circumstances. But in amongst all of that, what's so incredible is that once they actually implemented this Greenbelt, they didn't actually know what to do with it. Because so much of the land was private, so much of the land was a sort of aristocratic landholding, that they hadn't really understood this idea of public access. And so they came up to discuss this idea of having signs in the Greenbelt. And I'm fascinated that, you know, you're in Toronto, you drive into the Greenbelt and you're told by a little sign that here you are in the Greenbelt. Well, they had the same idea in London. They said, oh, well, let's have a sign. And they came up with this design. And they, you can see here this silhouette of a townsman who presumably is going to go over the hedge and into the Greenbelt. And they sort of literally quoted from here, Greenbelt appeared to convey to many people the mistaken idea that the whole property is open to the public. And so, you know, no, we can't have that. We can't have, you know, a whole lot of riffraff roaming over the countryside willy-nilly. And so, in fact, the idea for the signs of the Greenbelt was finally canned. So, you know, the Greenbelt in the UK, as I mentioned before at the beginning of my talk, lies in a sort of problematic space for a number of reasons, even to this day.
So it's not a bus stop.
It's a Greenbelt sign, yeah. To talk about the regional network. So that was about the dynamic meanings. Talk about the regional network. This is a sort of map of town planning schemes in London from the sort of late 20s. And here you can see what the planner at the time, was a man called George Pepler, came to be very well known, is trying to do. He's trying to sort of group local authorities together to see if there's some sort of networks that can be formed in this map. And I looked at this idea of the way in which, in the present day, the way in which local authorities communicate with each other and have the same idea, the same vision of what the Green Belt should mean. So I did this big kind of analysis of it was basically a content analysis of local authority meanings attached to the Greenbelt. Because in London, you've got around 50 or so local authorities that control the Greenbelt. It's kind of mandated by the national government. But then they have just sort of basically plans that implement the Greenbelt that the local And so I was curious about this and what this map shows.
We did a cluster analysis. So it was actually a statistical technique to look for the association of different meanings in the Greenbelt, one with the other. And this cluster analysis, you sort of do the put into SPSS, and then you split it off at a certain stage, and you have sort of something like five groups.
And you can see that, broadly speaking, the groups fall into these five categories. There's this group here, A's, which are sort of on the outer edges of the Greenbelt, very rural areas. You've got this group here, which is sort of almost
like inner urban fringy, kind of peri-urban type of areas.
You've got these groups here, these grey ones, which are kind of,
I guess for want of a better word, you'd call them sort of just NIMBY type of groups.
And then you've got these local authorities, which are sort of real outliers,
which somehow have just a completely different meaning of the Greenbelt, largely because so much of their land is sometimes outside the Greenbelt as it is, or their outer fringes or something like that. So we were able to kind of nicely look at these regional groupings and the factors which influence the meaning of the Greenbelt.
And of course, you know, it's sensible that the Greenbelt, although it's seen as this unitary, classically modernist type of planning policy, you know, imposed from above, rural, urban, you know, black and white, very classically zoning, it's sensible that at the local authority level, you know, they should tweak it whichever way they can, because of course Greenbelt landscapes are so varied. I mean, London's case varies from this kind of derelict urban fringe land to, you know, various sort of rural uses that you see typically on the fringes of cities, through to ex-greenhouse large sort of horticultural derelict areas. I mean, even London's largest airport, in fact, probably supposedly the world's busiest international airport, London Heathrow, is within the Greenbelt, so you can appreciate all the different uses that it has, as well as this sort of very rural use here. So when we think about the dynamic meanings, it's pretty instructive to use the Greenbelt Foundation's document from yesterday that was handed out as a reference, because they've put as this sort of public statement out of the conference yesterday that the resounding message from delegates is that all Greenbelts provide the following essential benefits: clean water, clean air, long-term agricultural viability, climate change adaptation mitigation, ecosystem services, fresh, healthy local food, social inclusion, inspirational well-being, healthy, active lifestyles, habitat and biodiversity, tourism, flood protection, cultural enhancement. There's something for everybody, you know. And so who could possibly not want to fund something which is so clearly in the public interest? Just to go back, I think it's also would be useful to look at the different ways in which, you know, I know that in the Toronto's case, not only do you have the Greenbelt and the Friends of the Greenbelt Foundation, but you've got a whole patchwork, effectively, of laws, of NGOs, I guess you call them, of advocacy groups that work together. And I think it's particularly interesting to look at how these different groups work together. And then finally, I want to talk about sort of the national level, and I guess more broadly the international level. I mean, the Greenbelt was, the Greenbelt idea was propelled, I think, at two key stages. One was in the early 20th century with the publication of Howard's Garden City Ideal and the way in which that was propagated around the world. To lesser or greater extents, of course, people had developed already their own endemic versions of Howard Garden City. But also, after the Second World War, a large number of cities were really inspired by the example of London in the UK and the work that had been done by Abercrombie. And I mean, you all probably know the story of Ottawa's Greenbelt, for example, and its role in building a sort of national capital for Canada. I mean, you know, that influence went as far as these four cities, which all to different extents had quote-unquote failed Greenbelts. But
I think the failure of the Greenbelt is particularly instructive when you look at it and its long-term repercussions for the planning system.
Because, for example, in Tokyo's case, they had started off in the 1930s to try and put in a sort of green girdle type of scheme. This map here is very well known. All these dots here are anti-aircraft emplacements, and they were basically seeing the Greenbelt as a useful way of keeping development free of anti-aircraft in gun emplacements for city protection. So that argument was made. And then after the Second World War, they tried a couple of schemes in the 40s and again in 1956 to implement a Greenbelt around Tokyo and contain the incredibly rapid urban growth that was taking place at that time. But what they had were vast protests from landowners, individual landowners, who were just horrified at the idea that they would have to be subject to these conditions. Such was the political protest, the pressure was put on the government, that by the 1960s, the Greenbelt had effectively been overrun by development, by largely illegal construction, but you know, no one enforced it or no one followed that up. You know, behind all of this, I mean, behind, I guess, what you call the glittering surface of Greenbelt success and failure, what you have, of course, are all the various murky waters that are involved in the planning system. You know, you've got things like property rights, you've got the constitutional issues, you've got the setup of individual institutions. And Japan's case is particularly instructive in terms of property rights, because the six-year U.S. occupation, one of the outcomes of that at the end of the Second World War was to introduce a new constitution to Japan, one of which guaranteed the property rights of individual landholders. So suddenly, on the one hand, you have this kind of Jeffersonian ideal of land ownership being opposed in Japan. But on the other hand, you have the Japanese planners trying to set up their planning system and trying to put in a greenbelt. And of course, the Jeffersonian ideal, I guess, the individual land ownership idea, won out over the public interest of the greenbelt. The long-term ramifications of that for Japanese planning were actually disastrous, because I don't think the Japanese planners or the planning system ever recovered from that political defeat. It was largely discredited. So I guess if you had to sort of talk about failure, you talk about abject failure, then you probably say the Japanese Greenbelt was something of an abject failure, because not only did the Greenbelt itself get eroded, but the planners themselves, politically speaking, weren't able to get any outcome out of that failure. Now, the Sydney Greenbelt is another example of failure. You've got Greenbelt being implemented in 1948, again, sort of very strongly influenced by Abercrombie, by this whole British idea. And you can see here these grey areas, these darkish areas of Greenbelt here. These black areas are actually areas of open space, largely remain because Sydney is a very, very hilly city, so these are sort of largely undeveloped sites, or they're being incorporated into national parks. And by the late 1950s, you've got these hatched areas here, greenbelt areas that are being lost, and you've got a few pockets remaining of greenbelt. But you know, it's the policy itself has largely failed, and the government has sort of acknowledged it. But what was interesting about the Sydney Greenbelt is that the planners said, okay, if you as the state government of New South Wales want to release the Greenbelt, what you have to do is you have to ensure that any development that occurs, the developers will compensate the community by paying the local authority for sewerage, for infrastructure, for libraries, and whatever. That's a term that's called planning gain in the UK, or it's, I guess you call it some sort of compensation or community compensation. And they called it developers' contributions. Such was the radicalism of this idea. They didn't really have a fully functioning
planning system in Australia at the time.
This idea that you could actually have development that was going to be properly serviced by infrastructure,
that it became the standard model that was used in all of the other states in Australia for planning. So, you know, that although the Greenbelt itself failed, there was a very positive political community outcome. And I guess that leads me on to sort of, I think, the central question of all of this, is if you have a fully functioning planning system, do you actually need a Greenbelt? And I think that's probably the main question I would ask for you.
The third example is this one of two kind of institutional examples. This is a map of the Seoul Greenbelt.
Now, in 1971, you had a dictatorship in Korea. You had a great deal of concern, of course, about North Korea. And you had a great deal of concern about the city of Seoul, which lies uncomfortably close to the demilitarized zone, getting larger and larger and closer to North Korea. So Dictator Park, at the time, imposed this greenbelt without any kind of consultation on the landscape, so effectively containing the city of Seoul. Now, when democracy came into South Korea in 1986, suddenly, you know, there was this whole big discussion about landowners' rights and property interests. And so the Korean government went through a very, very extensive, I would say probably quite painful exercise to try and reconcile, you know, the past, what they had actually gained from having this area preserved, and the future, in fact, how in fact you could restore landowners' rights in a free and fair and democratic way. And there's a whole sort of chapter about that in my book, but there's also a number of other publications that other people have written about that process. So that just sort of highlights how sometimes, you, with all the best will in the world, and perhaps even a dictatorial will, you can have a greenbelt imposed, but suddenly the rug, as it were, will be pulled out from underneath your feet by some kind of big institutional change, like democratization or something. And that brings me on to my final example, which is from New Zealand. Now, the city of Christchurch, again, was influenced by the UK. They had a greenbelt in the early 50s. But largely remained intact until the 1990s. But in the 1990s, the government introduced a reform of the way planning operated. And the boundaries of Christchurch, I mean, the boundaries of the regional council were changed from just the sort of Christchurch area to sort of one-third of the whole of the South Island, so a vast, vast area. And as it happened, the year that they did it, in 1990, they had a terrible rabbit infestation. Rabbits are a terrible pest in the Southern Hemisphere. Yesterday, someone showed a rabbit video at the end of the Greenbelt Conference, and one of the Australian people stood up and said how offensive it was, sort of kind of joke. But anyway, I mean, rabbits are a very, very serious problem in New Zealand. And so you can imagine that all these bureaucrats who were worrying about the Greenbelt and the sort of region around Christchurch were suddenly having to deal with a rabbit infestation that was occurring sort of 300 kilometres away in the King Country or in Otago. And so because of this change of scope that the government had implemented, the Greenbelt largely became an irrelevance. And it was basically an irrelevance for the bureaucracy because of the way it was changed. So, I mean, I really simplified the story. I mean, there was a whole lot of other stuff going on. But, you know, that's a sort of, again, another example of how institutional change taking place behind the scenes can radically reshape this whole idea of the Greenbelt and render it perhaps irrelevant. So, you know, from my story, it's not all doom and gloom. I think on the one hand, you have the example of the Copenhagen Finger Plan, where, you know, the idea, or even London in the 1920s and 30s, where the idea of the Greenbelt becomes this unifying rallying cry to planning. But on the other hand, you have this incredibly strong, supposedly strong concept, a strong sort of easily understood idea that is suddenly made completely irrelevant by an institutional change. So I guess that brings me on to my final point. yesterday in the conference, I scribbled down a few notes.
Well, what do you need to establish a greenbelt?
I think the first thing you need are important people, whether it's an elite.
Strong networks.
You need a whole range of networks and spies. It was particularly interesting to hear about San Francisco's greenbelt and the basically the sort of it's completely informal greenbelt alliance, but how cleverly they work and keep track of new developments taking place and so on. You need, of course, preparatory data, you know, to help you effectively understand and make justification for the preservation that you're going to impose. And of course you need funds, but you know, how those funds are spent are absolutely crucial. And you know, I think the Friends of the Greenbelt Foundation have been very, very savvy in not spending. They could have, for example, generated an income from the $25 million endowment that they had. They could have spent the $25 million on buying land. Or they could have done what they did do, which is to spend $25 million on marketing and awareness and effectively justifying and legitimizing the Greenbelt in the eyes of the public. Such that today, as you probably all know, the Greenbelt is supported by 9 out of 10 Torontonians, which is a remarkable figure. What's curious about the Greenbelt in the UK's case, although I sort of mentioned it was problematic, apart from understanding the planning system as this thing that kind of makes you worry about whether or not you can have a conservatory on the end of your house, people only understand the planning system as being about Greenbelts in the UK. Such is the force of this concept that they are seen to be incredibly popular but completely misunderstood, because people just think any bit of green land is green belt. And so, yeah, it sort of remains a continuing challenge for planners. What you need to keep a green belt is, I think, a very flexible attitude to what I call hard and soft functions. I think the soft functions are all of these flexible, dynamic meanings, such as agriculture, climate change, allocation, mitigation, and whatever you want to throw into the mix. But the hard functions are very interesting. One of the talks that we heard during the last 2 days was from basically the top bureaucrat in planning in Melbourne. And he mentioned about the green belt, the green wedges in Melbourne, and how the airport sits in a green wedge in Melbourne. And because the development has largely been excluded from around the airport of Melbourne, it means that they can fly planes in and out of Melbourne 24 hours a day. Now in Sydney, we have development that almost goes up to the edge of the airport. In reality, that would have actually been changed by the Greenbelt because the airport is so close to the CBD anyway. But it is a real problem for Sydney because one, of course, you've got this corridor of depressed house prices where the planes fly in low. I've got a friend who's at the University of Sydney, and well, she's got 4 kids, so it doesn't really make a difference in terms of the noise, but you literally have to stop talking when a plane flies over because they come in so low. And because of that, it of course means that the airport has very limited operating hours, so they can't operate after 11 o'clock at night, whereas the Melbourne airport that sits in the green belt or in the green wedge can. So that, of course, has a huge economic benefit. So when you point to these hard functions, of course, it's very important to make these connections with economic viability. And I think, finally, what you need is a space or recognition in the planning system. You need something in the planning system that allows the green belt to be untouched as a space for discussion. You know, you need to keep it immune from discussion so that it's just taken as a given by all the players around the table. And I think that sort of making that space in the planning system is already being done in the case of Canada. I mean, you know, the Places to Grow Act received an award from the Planning Institute in Canada. I think also the Greenbelt Plan received an award from the American Planning Association or something. I'm a bit foggy on the details, but I know that that sort of process of creating a space in the planning system has already begun. And then finally, yeah, we'll watch out for rabbits or watch out for kind of institutional change that can occur from all kinds of different directions.
And I kind of end it with this grid map
of South Australia, because I think that really the future of the Greenbelt is perhaps, well, if I were setting up the Greenbelt or if I were advising on maintaining the Greenbelt, I would look to climate change mitigation adaptation as one of the major reasons. And all of the work for that has already been done in the past.
This is an interesting... This map is
drawn up by the surveyor George Goyder in the sort of 1860s around Adelaide.
And you can see here you've got a grid of the city in the middle. You've got what is now
and still remains the Adelaide parklands around.
And then it was just assumed that when
people were colonising this city, they would
have a plot of land that was in the city, but also a farm plot on the outskirts of the city.
And I think that this idea of the interaction of the city and the surrounding hinterland should remain fundamental to how you put in a greenbelt and how you do that from a climate change adaptation mitigation point of view. And I think that that sort of will remain, I think, a very powerful discourse for preserving farmland on the outskirts of the city. So it's this getting this relationship between the city and the hinterland right that's so important. I'll just finish with this little story. In the 1980s, the comedian Ben Elton wrote a book about, I mean, he's a sort of not only a comedian, but also a very passionate environmentalist. And he wrote a book about the future of the environment was going to be dominated by having kind of large glass bell jars on the over the city to effectively stop, you know, what you have with something like the ecological footprint, you know, to enable the feedback loops within the city to be much shorter, so that the effects of the city could be understood much more easily by the dwellers there. So again, you know, this idea of the ecological footprint, the idea of connecting the city to the hinterland, I think remain very, very powerful incentives for preserving the Greenbelt. So that's all I want to say. Thank you. Thank you. So it's a very contentious issue in the UK, and I think that they were just being politically aware that if they were going to open up the Greenbelt to, you know, access, well, then it might actually offend the landowners who were going to be contributing the land. So.
that isn't it's really just about rambling. That's not like a veneer for trying to undermine property rights.
No.
In general.
No, I'm sure it's just about. I could imagine it's probably just about rambling. What was the second part?
Second is, were there mechanisms to actually assess how people were using the land? Whether the benefits that were being claimed were being delivered?
I think not really, because after 1938 they introduced this act where all of the land that had been bought privately became sort of officially recognized and sort of preserved in forever. And then, of course, in 1947 they changed the planning system again and gave a huge discretionary role to planners. And then in 1955, they had this national kind of mandate that all cities should look at having green belts. So today, around, in the UK, you have 13 green belts. I don't actually know. I mean, people have done studies, but the last sort of big study of the green belts was done as late as 1990. That looked at recreational benefits and that looked at what the ordinary public thought of green belts and so on. And I don't actually think since then it's really been looked at. I mean, I think people have just kind of, in the UK at any rate, have just kind of parked it somewhere and just left it as a kind of given in the planning system.
My name is Sean Banjo. I'm a graduate student here from York. I was curious, in places where there are strong individual property rights, or in some failed cases that you spoke of, outside of another institutional turnaround or some large radical change, do you have any ideas of potential ways that you can try to reintroduce such an idea, or is it one of those things where the idea of a green belt in these situations is kind of like a black sheep that no one talks about? Going to have to go about it another way, or do you think there's any...
So you mean, once it's failed, can it ever come back again?
Yeah.
Like a comeback kid example? I don't know. I mean, I think... to go back to the Japanese case, again, it's more complicated than just a simple case of abject failure, because what you had there is, of course... a very, very specific kind of landscape on the fringes of Tokyo. You had a radically different agricultural system compared to the UK. And here they were, under this whole mandate of becoming a progressive country, borrowing effectively a Western planning system. So I think one of the upshots of what happened was that they began to look seriously at their own planning system and come up with an indigenous planning system that was better suited to their locality. And so, one of the problems that you have here in Toronto with the Greenbelt is the aging of farmers, basically keeping farmers on board as part of the whole Greenbelt idea. And you should actually be looking to Japan, because they've got some very interesting examples of farmland preservation. Although for them, the ethic is not about preserving land on the outskirts of the city, it's about preserving farmland in the city and the role that farmland has to play in the city. It's one of the societies that's aging faster than any other. So I guess that what happens is that the Greenbelt itself, I don't know of any example where the Greenbelt has been changed radically and then someone's reintroduced it perhaps on a new institutional structure. In Melbourne's case, they had green wedges that were put in 1971. Then they had a very, very neoconservative liberal government who came in, rather like perhaps the change that you might have in Toronto, in Ontario, with the potential change here. So they had that. And then thanks to the work, in fact, of Michael Buxton, who was at the conference, he actually got, the minister, when the next government came in, he got the minister and the head of the top bureaucrat to get around the table and said, well, here's the green belt, here's the green wedges that your previous government had largely ignored. what are you going to do about that? And they're, oh, we'll put in an overgrowth boundary. And so, you know, then suddenly the thing was reinstituted. So perhaps it's not as, you know, dire as you might think it is.
Thank you for this interesting talk. I have a question about your methodology, really, because it isn't really clear to me how those cases that you compare hang together. Mm. What is the basis? What's the theoretical conceptual basis? Mm. To give you an example, the Greenbelt I know best is the Frankfurt Greenbelt. When it was conceived in the 1920s, the cities in developed industrial countries like Germany would have had industrial development in large plans. And it would have sort of a medieval residue, which Frankfurt had. It had the largest medieval downtown in Europe, and which was the core of the city. And as we learned a couple of days ago, then, you know, so you have this radial development of the city along these, first the Baroque Lassie, and then the modern 19th century city, and the factories were sort of the outside. There was a logic to the fact that you put a belt around it, that's the way cities grew, and Frankfurt, much like Toronto, grew from the center outward. It didn't have a lake at the bottom, but it had two rivers, so the natural landscapes played their own role, if I were to enact the network analysis, so we can, you know, it's not just the planners, and it's also the landscape itself, which sort of pre-structures the idea we think about this, but nevertheless, in the 20s, it made perfect sense to have that. By the way, there was something very similar to the Adelaide plan, because in the 20s, the communist and social democratic planners who thought about the green belt and the housing that went along with it developed stepwise migration of housing into the green belt so that the people at the outer edges in these large housing estates that were built at the outskirts of Frankfurt in the 20s, before the Nazis came in and changed this completely. Mm-hmm. Under the social democratic rule, they actually each had truck gardens in the back. So each individual working class household had a garden pointing towards the green belt, and then there was an intermediary little belt in the river, and on the other side of the field. So it was a gradiated way of emphasizing the way the structure of the city and the industrial inhabitants of that city would sort of work together. But in the 90s, when we, worked on the green belt, and we had these 2 years of devising the plans that those of you who were at the conference saw, that is now the green belt of Frankfurt, we still went to the center of the city. The first map we produced was we put up a map of Frankfurt we drew with three circles.
Yeah.
We put an arrow in the middle, which was the city hall of Frankfurt, which is a medieval city hall. That's like putting an arrow in Toronto City Hall, which is right in the center of the city. And then we developed it up. But the moment we did this, we knew we were up against something very dramatic, which is that, of course, this was a conceptual idea which had no bearing on the reality of what a post-Fordist city looked like.
Yeah.
So we were, and that includes the story about the airport that you told about Melbourne and Sydney, because the Frankfurt Airport is in the Green Belt. So the question about how you reconcile the reality of a centrally shaped, concentric city with this concentric expansion of the Green Belt with a completely fragmented and exploding post-Fordist, which we call that, that's why I'm using the word, that's the theoretical idea.
Yeah, yeah.
The post-Fordist globalizing city, in which we argued at the time, in fact, what is happening is that the center is moving out of the center of Frankfurt into the Green Belt, because the center, as Klaus Wiesche again emphasized yesterday, is that the airport is the largest employer, the airport of Frankfurt is the largest employer in Germany, all of Germany. Right? So in the 1960s, this would have been probably some mine or an automobile plant or some such thing. But by 1990 and now 2011, it is the airport, which is in the Green Belt, which is the actual center of the global city economy of Frankfurt. So now, to go back to your methodology, from that story of, you know, the 70 years difference between 1920 and 1990, and now I can even see some more changes 20 years later, that comparison makes no sense to me whatsoever, because you're actually talking about very different cities, in very different political economies, in very different worlds. And one more footnote to that is also that, you know, I'm very surprised about the Tokyo story, because I would have thought of the developmental state, which was so successful in places like Hong Kong and Singapore, but also in Japan, Japanese cities, that the developmental state would have actually, like in Seoul, be much more authoritative, not necessarily authoritarian because it's Japan, but authoritative in preserving the land to exactly achieve what a post-Fordist economy needs, which is the marrying of post-industrial values with a post-industrial economy, you know, of the creative city, of high-tech development, office parks. You know, the dune that Klaus Fischer was talking about in Frankfurt, the most valuable green space in the Greenbelt in Frankfurt, is right adjacent to the high-tech industry of Frankfurt, right?
Yeah, of course.
And that is, these are the kinds of things that don't show in that comparison, because, you know, there are too many things happening between, you know, Christchurch and... So I would like you to explain a little bit what your conceptual, theoretical bases are from which you make this.
I guess my kind of basis was to try and... my initial basis as a PhD student, you know, was to try and speak to the reform of the Greenbelt in London, in the UK's case, and particularly to undermine this idea that it was this great victorious kind of scheme that had been implemented by all these famous planners, and that it was inherently problematic. But I hadn't actually, of course, I mean, you know, the title of my book is Greenbelts in the 21st Century. And I try to look at different ways of planning, I guess, something which is inherently modernist in a postmodern way. And I think, but I haven't gone so far as to consider things like edge cities, which for me, I think, largely kind of just obliterate the need for a Greenbelt. I mean, they just, you know, when you read something like an edge city, or you read about those kind of global forces, which are so unstructured and overwhelming, I kind of think, oh gosh, you know, how can you possibly have a green belt in that sort of situation? And the only solution, I guess, is to throw up your hands, or in fact to look back at the Joel Garrow's analysis, where he also talks about how green space adds a terrific amount of value, and you know, the new office development that they're putting in the edge city is kind of very high tech in such a way that they can actually insert it into the existing forest rather than just raising it and rebuilding it new. So I guess you know, my theoretical basis is underpinned by a need to, I think, just go behind the scenes of what actually takes place in the Greenbelt implementation, rather than to consider sort of the bigger issues of the way in which you try to reconcile these two things, but I certainly acknowledge it's a very important question.
It's more like a common question. I was very amazed to find out that in Barcelona, for instance, they create jobs for various groups, vulnerable groups, none of them elderly, and the elderly that fully in the urban life are able to work outside the city. And it's a movement. It's not just seniors, but everybody seems to be interested, you know, in the city and in the farmlands and places that are abandoned. So I don't even know if there's a green belt in Barcelona, for instance, but there is a movement that's fantastic, whether it is a green belt or not a green belt, but if there is a movement that the public actually supports the farmland and the government supports the creation of jobs, and of course the renewable energy, that's fantastic. And Portugal, on the other hand, is amazing that it's so successful this, the attraction of the urban population coming to the farms too, that worldwide they're coming to study that model. So when you see cities like that and ourselves in Toronto with the land that we have in Ontario, someone yesterday was talking about Sarnia, they may not have agriculture, but they have renewable energy, creating jobs with solar panels. And why can we not do that? We have the space. We have the space for everything in Ontario, right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd be probably more people, I don't know, like a small population.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's your opinion?
I think those examples are really interesting because it goes back to this idea of trying to connect the city and the rural areas together. And again, my experience of that has been again in Japan, where there are terrific schemes for trying to involve, particularly it's a focus on elderly people as well, in farming. And there's even a kind of a scheme in Japan where elderly people, as a volunteer, they help out their local farmer in the urban area. So I think that, there's certainly some interesting scope to look at those examples further, and also the example of Sao Paulo, which I hadn't heard of before, which was talked about at the conference. So,
hopefully, all this influence your people.
This kind of draws, I think, two previous questions in a little bit. I'm curious about the way that you're conceptualizing the hard and soft questions. I was really struck, I guess, because. So I don't think it's like a totally open question. I would be inclined to say that softer functions would be the things that would be much harder to quantify, things that are obviously incredibly important. I was floored by how many times in this conference people just sort of threw out the need to walk in the forest as an absolutely, in their mind, legitimate justification, an obvious justification for the green belt. So I would think about those kinds of things as potentially soft functions, and then more like the quantifiable political economy stuff as hard functions. So I was really curious about your grouping of flexible meetings and the climate change mitigation.
Oh gosh, well, I haven't really sort of thought about it that much. I mean, to be honest, I mean, these binaries are always so problematic, hard and soft. I mean, they're just useful to put up with bullet points at the end of a presentation more than anything else. But okay, I mean, I think, on what basis, so you're asking on what basis can you classify?
Right, I think it's really challengingly. I just am curious, you put them together in that way, so I was curious what kind of category you were making there.
Well, I don't know. I guess the distinction is, as you said, between what you can quantify and what you can't, and that of course relates to the justification that you make for preserving and maintaining the green belt as it is. But I think that those softer meanings or those ones have a utility in their flexibility. When I was doing my PhD, I was particularly influenced by Foucault, but also by Ben Fluberg's analysis of Aalborg and rationality and power. And in it, he talks about the polyvalency of meanings in planning. And I realized that sort of polyvalent nature of these softer meanings is absolutely crucial when you've got a powerful concept to try and put a powerful.
Well, this seems like, one of the reasons I underline this is it seems like an important part of your analysis in this, especially when I look, coming out of this Toronto context, in which all of the hard reasons that are the reasons that are actually discussed in the Greenbelt plan,
sure.
For example, about infrastructure, about water provision,
yep.
aren't actually measured in a way that
makes them hard.
That makes them hard, right. Mm. And they're not the things that are used to, it's always surprising to me, they're not the things.
But the minister, when he quoted, when Jim Bradley spoke 2 days ago, he just like it was like $30 billion here, it was all numbers. It was all numbers.
Yeah, it's interesting because what I take from that, the flexible attitude to soft hard function and how it goes in here and gets translated, is that I was very much thinking that you have to have a flexible attitude to the ways in which you discuss it. That's kind of the soft meaning part of it. So one of the things that makes successful planning policy is that everybody sees themselves in it. So if I'm interested in climate change, if I'm interested in the walk in the woods, if I think that my children need to have a greater engagement with nature, if I want fresh food, you know, further to the list that you included, you know, that meaning, if you're very open to that, and it successfully weathers the different ways that people talk about it, then you're kind of very successful. And then the hard part of it, the hard function, I went straight to thinking about material landscape. So, you know, the airport is a very material thing. If it's the type of thing that can be included in a greenbelt, then that's a good thing because it helps the larger functioning of the region. And perhaps it's my, I grew up in Ottawa, and Ottawa has a greenbelt, and the greenbelt is a place of things where the federal government can basically go, right, we need a place for that. And so they put really big stuff in there that there's no land to put anywhere else. And so it's been, you know, there's been a couple of technology campuses. The Ottawa's airport is in the greenbelt. And so if you're okay to kind of include some of those things without it breaking apart the whole idea, then that's really good too. And yet, having said that, just for the students here, you know, in the case of Toronto, this is our third green belt. There was a green belt back in the 30s. Jim Lemon has written about this. And it was a little weak green belt because Toronto was a little in the weak back then. And so there's little bits and pieces of it. So where I live next to the river, there's part of a road. It was supposed to be a green belt in the parkway. It was actually part of a road that goes nowhere. And I've always been interested in that. And finally,
well, it's a parkway idea.
Original green belt, and then we had the parkway belt, which was to be a multifunctional space that was going to separate all of the different communities in the broader Toronto region, and yet it became a place of only hard functions. So it's a place where all of our highways, electricity corridors, gas lines, we're all like put all of the infrastructure. Became an infrastructure corridor instead of a place of a walk in the woods and a place of recreation and all that kind of stuff. So I think that there's a lot of that's a really interesting way to look at it. The soft and hardness.
But also, I mean, the softness really changes. I mean, this is
sure.
I was really horrified by this repeated reference to this walk in the woods business. You know, we make fun on German, right? So my wife and I make fun when we go down to the boardwalk on a Sunday. There were people actually walking on the boardwalk in the beaches like that. Walk, and there always two guys ahead and two women behind. So when you sidle up to them and you listen to the language they're speaking, they're either Polish or German or Russian. It's absolutely clear because that's what Germans and Poles and Russians like to do. They go on Sunday walks. But I don't see Salvation families on Sunday walks. They're rather in the picnic grounds. They are barbecuing. You know, everybody does something else, and this idea, this English idea of walking in the woods, I mean, the first guy, the first man, he's just pretty quite, I mean, the country guy.
Yeah, he was from the same, I mean, he was 1926.
That was just outrageous. So, what the soft thing really needs to be thought about in different terms, you know, what are the demands of a society of 6 million people, when they say 90% of the Torontonians are in favor of the greenbelt, or when you ask your two taxi drivers, Laura, you know, I guess they were Salvation, and you know, what do they actually associate with greenbelt?
Exactly.
Because when you're a Chinese fisherman, you go up to the greenbelt in Ottawa and try to fish, you can get pushed into the water, right? So there are all kinds of racialized and class issues around what that all means, what fresh air means and all that. So that needs to be really strengthened in the discourse to come up with that. And that needs to be weighed against the very uncompromising and hard functions of the global city. You know, like airports and all these other things.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to your question a few years ago, I went to a Greenways conference, Greenways, Greenbelt. And there was this Chinese academic who told me boldly that they had put in in the last year 30 garden cities around China, different places. I mean, this is the speed of development. So I think that when you look at like the future of the Greenbelt, perhaps when we look at Toronto, maybe we're looking in the wrong place. And maybe we will see the future of the Greenbelt or these big preservation schemes or even of regional planning in general. We'll see what that looks like when you look at China and the way things are done there. And I would imagine that, you know, talking about Frankfurt and the way in which these things were reconciled and the way they did see the value of green space in some way, I would imagine that the Chinese are probably pretty much doing the same thing. I mean, and there they don't really have to worry too much about democracy and local groups and so on. So, you know, yeah, I mean, but I think also, but to go back to the sort of the Chinese immigrant who's going to be fishing in the Greenbelt and being pushed into the water, I mean, I guess my question is, does the Greenbelt Foundation care about that sector of convincing that sector of the population about the Greenbelt? Or is it a parallel to the CPRE with all of its aristocratic and elitist leanings?
Okay. That's what I want to know.
I guess I'm more familiar with the Ottawa case, which has a green wing, right, also? Mm-hmm. Green wing and green wing and all the
yeah. So.
And I guess the question or comment is, I wonder if there's also a, because when it was put in the 60s, it comes stemming from like the 1940s, the Great Barrier Report, so much different function. And then since amalgamation, it seems like it's almost become a separation between like old city Ottawa and area, which is like a semi kind of rural. Mm-hmm. And I'm also wondering if there's kind of this like discursive function. Mm-hmm. Because especially Ottawa there in the last 5 years where they've been really pushing for intensification within sort of the central area, which is well within the Greenbelt. But a lot of the sort of stuff that I hear about developing that sound part, any mention of green space within the city, mm-hmm. a lot of it ends up being only the Greenbelt.
Oh, right.
That's where the nature is.
Oh, I see.
As if people, you know, would drive
that's enough.
Over a walk. Yeah. Because it, so I'm wondering if there's also kind of this sort of discursive function that is very material that sort of affects. Like now, like in Ottawa, it's fairly big in green neighborhoods in a lot of places and kind of move towards those open. Because there's, I don't know if it's because there's a green belt, but it kind of has this layer.
So you mean the green belt itself helps to preserve the leafy green neighborhoods, or the leafy green neighborhoods become densified and
yeah, so
because there is a green belt already?
I did my MA in Ottawa, and it came up again and again that new developments, it's more important to fill in the space because there's a green belt. Because we have a green belt, we don't need, you know, the nature goes over there. It's a very separating kind of nature culture, I guess. I'm just wondering if you've seen like that in the other cases. It's a little different, I guess, in Garden City, where it's kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, the approach that was used in, I mean, there's the texts that you can look at from the 1950s, Keeble, Lewis Keeble, a sort of famous modernist planner, he wrote this textbook that became de rigueur among planners in the 50s and 60s. And he kind of tried to calculate the ideal size of the city based on sort of somebody accessing the Greenbelt on the outskirts. So you needed sort of, you know, the townsman, as it was called, would need a particular size, and you could calculate the circumference, a particular density, you know, to basically be within, say, like 10 minutes access to the Greenbelt. So I think that's one aspect of it, is this the idea that you should be able to access the Greenbelt very easily. I think it's a very kind of modernist claim. But at the same time, the good plans, as they were judged for say, like London, for example, as well as having the Greenbelt on the outskirts, there was supposedly this big green web and this that was to run along, sometimes existing derelict canals or various linking of various parts of London and so on. So, you know, in theory, I think, from a modernist point of view, you should, as well as having the green belt, you look, should be looking for this kind of green web to be there to sort of bring nature into the city as well. I could say the short answer to your question is no. I haven't seen something similar to that. But I would sort of look upon it as being quite an unusual case because of the whole trend towards trying to access the green belt more generally.
I'm very mindful of the time, so we can continue